Today on the 21st Show, Steve Vogel spent years as a radio broadcaster in Central Illinois. He's also written a pair of true crime books, one of them a New York Times bestseller. Now he's turning his attention to his own life and has come out with a memoir, Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories, including some I'd just as soon forget. It recounts another tumultuous time in American history, notable moments from his career, including a debate between Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem, and his perspective on the changes in American life over the last half century. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Bloomington Normal, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And as my guest today can tell you, a lot has changed about the media landscape over the past 40 years. Heck, a lot has changed in the past 40 weeks. That's in part because of the chaotic era through which we're living. And that, in turn, is partly because of major changes in how people get their news. There's a temptation to say we're living through unprecedented times. But as Steve Vogel can tell you, some of what we're seeing is history repeating itself, or at least rhyming. Vogel's name might be familiar to our listeners in the Bloomington Normal area, where he was a longtime radio broadcaster. You might also know him as the author of the New York Times bestselling true crime thriller Reasonable Doubt, considered a classic of the genre, and which explores the true story of the brutal murder of a Bloomington mother and her three children. Now he's turning his journalistic attention to his own life and has come out with a memoir. It's called Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories, including some I'd just as soon forget. It recounts a series of episodes from childhood through his working life. Steve joins me now in studio in Urbana. Steve Vogel, welcome back to The 21st Show.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be here.
Listeners, you can join us today throughout the hour at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, I thought we'd start where you do in the book, which is an episode in Washington, D.C., an awakening of sorts for you. Set the scene.
Well, it was in 1968, a very volatile year in American history, the year of the King assassination, the year of the Robert Kennedy killing, the year of the violence of the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the year of the a lot of race riots in American cities, and the year of the Black Power salute in Mexico City, where two American athletes raised their gloved black hand and fist in the air and then got ejected from the Olympics because of that. Juan Carlos was one of the two Olympians, and he held the first news conference in Washington, D.C.
And what are you doing in D.C.
after the fact? I was a graduate student at Northwestern University, sent to their Washington program, and I became that was really my first Washington news conference. And I left downtown Washington onto a bus. As I say in the book, I was, kind of a mixed race bus going there. And the further we went into the area where the news conference was going to be held, I became a minority for the first time in my life.
Yeah. And we'll get into your the town you grew up in. But yeah, suffice to say, not a lot of diversity in your life until that point.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Got to the part of town where the news conference was being held, and I'm wondering, where is this going to be? We were right where there was great destruction because of the race riots. And there was this black-owned supper club that had been untouched, and they were having the news conference in the courtyard of that place. So there we went. There were a lot of media there. This was a big event. I'm guessing there were five or six dozen reporters and photographers there. And the woman, who I think was Angela Davis, but I'm not sure, stood up and said, "We told the media to send their black reporters. The next time, you white boys aren't going to get in." Now, in that group of several dozen media people that were mostly men, but not all men, but there were very few blacks. I'm going to say maybe three in the entire group, and that's hard to fathom today, but that's the way it was back then. Well, at that point, someone in the back of the room, a black voice, said, "String them up." Well, that's something I had heard before, but not personally, but I knew what it meant. But it didn't usually apply to white people. And that was a tense, very tense situation in that room. There were some nervous twitters and the like. The news conference went on well after that. I mean, that was a gathering of black power. I mean, Harry Edwards was there. Dick Gregory was there. H.R.F. Brown was there. I forget all who was there, but it was quite the gathering.
How does that shape the way you think about race in the moment and in the years ahead through your career?
Well, it was an awakening for me because it helped me realize that my white being was an advantage and one that I didn't earn in any particular way. But it was, you know, I came from a small town where 2,000 people and the only minority was one Jewish family in town. And I had not been around that many black people. A few in college went to Illinois Wesleyan, where there was only a handful of blacks in the enrollment at that time. And so it was an awakening for me.
Yeah. Let's talk about your early life. So you are from the town of Minunk, if I'm saying that correctly.
You're right.
I checked
yep.
it in the INBA pronunciation guide. what was it like back in those days?
Well, it was a rural town where agriculture was the center of the community. A two-block-long business district with a grain elevator alongside the railroad tracks. Lots of churches. And in addition to a public high school and a public grade school, there was a Catholic grade school, the only one for many miles around, run by four Franciscan nuns. And that's where I went to school and got my education and my early religious training. And so that opened the door to a lot of different experiences, some of which I write about in Broadcast Life.
Yeah, so let's talk about that religious experience. What was your religious upbringing like? And were Catholics a minority in this town, as they were in some small towns in Central
Illinois? Yeah, but
there
were a significant minority. There were a lot of Polish and Irish people
with
that background in the community. But there were Baptists and Methodists and Presbyterians and Lutherans as well. And as I indicated, that one Jewish family.
Yeah.
And it was a thing to drive by their house at Christmas time and just see the fact there was no Christmas tree there. That's something you did in Minunk at the time.
Well, maybe that gets at the excitement that was happening in Minunk. And one of the ways you chart that I thought was interesting is the arrival of television. Before TV, BTV, and ATV, you might say. Talk about that. What was like Saturday night in Minunk?
Well, Saturday night was when the farm community came to town. Mom bought her groceries and Dad maybe got a few farm supplies and then maybe drank a glass of beer at one of the three taverns in town. But it was a happening place. Kids had their routines and you spent a couple hours there. And it was a fun thing. But this is a community, just like so many other up and down Illinois, where 15, 20 years earlier, there was no electricity on the farms. And then suddenly, these kind of status symbols, these TV towers with an antenna, started to appear on people's homes out there in rural America. And the thing that I most remember is, not exactly overnight, but very close to it, the nature of what happened in downtown Minunk on a Saturday night changed, and that was because Gunsmoke arrived on television. Very popular show back in the day with Matt Dillon and Chester and Doc and all those guys, and it broadcast on Saturday night. And people stayed home back in the days when we had appointment watching on television. People stayed home to watch Gunsmoke. And so it suddenly became easier to find a parking spot in downtown Minunk on Saturday night. And some businesses that used to be open on Saturday even closed early.
I've heard so many theories for why American downtowns, especially in smaller towns, have been hollowed out over the past couple of generations, right? Deindustrialization, people leaving for the big cities. I had not heard that particular hypothesis that Gunsmoke in particular, or TV in general, I guess. But you felt it. You could feel it there.
Yeah, I really did.
Yeah. What do you think it says about the idea that it was Gunsmoke? You know, we're in the midst of a national conversation, if you will. I'm not wild about that phrase, but about American violence and guns and things like that. What does it say that show in particular is what captured people's imaginations, as opposed to, you know, Perry Mason, Route 66, some of the other offerings on air at the time?
Well, there were Westerns on TV back then, but they were the Hopalong Cassidy, Roy Rogers type of Westerns. Gunsmoke was adult drama. Mm-hmm. I mean, there wasn't much violence. There were a few gunshots exchanged once in a while, but basically it was about Kitty, who ran a saloon, and Matt Dillon, who tried to keep the town safe, and some of the characters. There was Doc, who patched people up after they had a horse accident or a gunshot wound. And then there, of course, was Chester. He was the guy who had served the Confederacy during the Civil War, but suddenly he wasn't really clear whether he really had a badge or not, but he was certainly Matt Dillon's accomplice in trying to make things smooth for the people of that town.
Yeah, yeah. All right, you also write in the book, when you were young, about an experience with bullying. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it really was impactful to me. It seems rather remarkable today, but the kids who went to St. Patrick's grade school walked a block or two to the high school and availed themselves of the noontime lunch, subsidized lunch. I'm not sure that was even constitutional at the time. I don't know. But it seemed unusual to me then and even now. But we would go there, and that was the back in the day when there wasn't much selection in the cafeteria. You had the little green or gray tray with the little compartments on it, and they put the applesauce here and the beef and noodles there and the sliced pears over here. And you walked through and got your stuff. There wasn't any choice. You just took it or left. So at any rate, I was there every day. I think the lunch cost 35 cents, and you got your choice of a half pint of white or chocolate milk. But there was a boy who was probably a junior in high school who worked in the cafeteria. That was, I guess he earned a little money, or that was part of the deal. But he decided that he would pick on me, and he would. And there were maybe six or eight of us kids, my classmates, who would sit together at a table and eat. But he would always come to me and pick on me. And what he liked to do was clench the back of my neck with his hands, and he would just press hard until I cried. And he would do that day after day. And I mean,
you can imagine. You're an elementary school kid. This is a high school kid.
Yeah, I was probably fifth or sixth grade, and this was a high school kid. And he did that for days on end. I'm going to say it went on for 2 weeks, and you can imagine how little I look forward to going to lunch or even to school at that point. So I was a victim of bullying. But one day, one of our class leaders, the boy who was most respected and liked in our class, was sitting there. And he said to the boy, "Why don't you leave him alone?" And the bully just kind of sulked away at that point and never came back and bothered me ever again. But that left a mark on me, and it gave me an appreciation for how bad bullying can be.
Yeah. I wonder, you talk about how you grew up mostly as an only child. You know, bullying today is often more online. It's more faceless. It doesn't have that personal element. I wonder if you've thought about how you might have fared in the modern environment in that circumstance.
I haven't really thought too much about that. I know it's definitely an issue, a significant issue that we have to be attentive to.
Yeah. One of our producers was fascinated by the direct sale of chicken eggs. Maybe you can talk about that, something that is a pretty remote for people who might have grown up in a city and not had
it
experience.
Is. Small farm. It was only a 120-acre farm, and until my parents decided when I was about seventh grade that they were going to have two sons who probably wanted to college, it was just basically a grain and small livestock farm. Eventually, we got into dairying, and that was a little more of a cash flow thing. But every farm back in those days, I think, had a chicken house, and it would contain maybe 200 or 300 chickens. And once or twice a day, you'd go out there and gather the eggs. And into a wire basket and then take them to the basement where you would cleanse them if necessary and then put them into large containers. And then once a week, the Eggman would come, and he would pay you the market price for the dozens of eggs. And back then, I'm thinking it was like 35 or at the most 37 cents a dozen.
Hmm. But right out of the house, yeah.
Right out of the house, and then and I don't know where they would go from there, whether they would go directly to area grocery stores or go beyond that. But, I mean, this guy was, you know, only picking up, I don't know, 12 or 15 dozen eggs from us at a time. That was our grocery money then.
All right, we are going to take a break. We are speaking with Steve Vogel, who's the author of a new memoir. It's called Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories, including some I'd just as soon forget. It explores his childhood and his career as a radio broadcaster and some of the lessons and experiences he's learned along the way. You can join the conversation today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to tease a little something that's going to come up a little later in our conversation with our exit music going to break here. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with Steve Vogel. He is known to our listeners in Bloomington Normal as a longtime radio broadcaster there. Fans of the true crime thriller genre might remember him as the author of Reasonable Doubt, the New York Times bestseller. He's now out with a memoir called Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories, including some I'd just as soon forget. It explores his life from childhood through his career as a radio broadcaster and some of the lessons he's taken away from those experiences. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. Maybe you remember listening to Steve in Bloomington. Let us know your memories of that. 800-222-9455 or anything else you want to talk about. 800-222-9455 is the number. Let's talk about your career. Tell me about what the pantograph was like when you worked there.
Well, I was a college student. That really is where I got my most of my journalism education.
Hmm.
Back in those days, the pantograph was a very, it really was one of the America's best small city dailies. And so I feel very lucky to have worked at the pantograph, mostly in the sports department. Had a rigorous editor there who demanded excellence, And I learned the hard way sometimes, but it was really a good education. Then I went to graduate school at Northwestern, got a master's in journalism, a graduate degree that was interrupted by 2 years in the military. And one year of that military was on American Forces Radio in Europe. So that was more of my journalism experience before actually taking a full-time job in radio in Bloomington.
You know, newspapers, there's a lot of overlap nowadays. A lot of former newspaper people now work in radio. Were you particularly motivated one way or the other in your early days?
I was always thinking print, but I had dabbled in radio just a little bit as a college kid, kind of enjoyed it. And then when the opportunity came in the Army, I took that, obviously, because it didn't involve holding a rifle very often.
Yes.
And
how did that come about, if you didn't?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but essentially I was surprised to be sent to Europe instead of Vietnam and found out that the AFN was having auditions at the time. And so I took the opportunity to audition and really don't remember much about it, except to say I wound up on the American Forces radio station in Nuremberg, Germany, and it was a good experience.
But you were, it was a lucky dice roll that you were sent to Europe and not Vietnam, or did you call a congressman or family connections or anything like that?
I don't know. I don't really understand that. I've had a military career that I can honestly say was probably unlike any other member of the military, because a good portion of my first year in the military was spent as the director of the Green Beret Chorus.
Didn't even know the Green Berets had a choir.
Well, they did back then. That was back in the Barry Sadler Ballad of the Green Beret days.
Okay.
General Edward Flanagan was the commander of the Special Forces at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and that was his thing. And I had just a tiny bit of musical experience, and they couldn't find anybody else within the ranks of the Green Berets. So I was attached to the Special, Psychological Operations Battalion there, and they found me, and that led me to direct the Green Beret Chorus, which also included some interesting experiences.
Yeah. What is it like working for American Forces Radio at this time? I mean, the media is... You know, America has this rising counterculture. A lot of people are not happy to be in the military at that time. It's not certainly not an all-volunteer military we have today. What was that like?
It was American Forces Radio, when I was in the military in the early 1970s, was really it for American forces in Europe. There was no American TV yet. The internet didn't exist. Other than your letters from home, AFN was how you kept in touch with America. We were an American radio station that had access to all of the commercial networks. In other words, we could cherry pick the programming. You could hear Paul Harvey, and you could hear the Indy 500, and you could hear the Kentucky Derby, and we did our own 5-minute top of the hour newscasts, but we could also cherry pick the best reports from the various networks. So it was quite the experience. Not only did Americans listen to it, obviously it was in English, but it was also a touchstone for a lot of Europeans, because the radio in Europe at that time was almost all cultural programming. You heard symphonies and opera and the like. And it was just beginning in Britain where there was pirate radio with rock and roll music. But if you wanted to hear Johnny Cash or the Carpenters or Duane Eddy or Little Richard, you had to listen to AFN. And it was where a lot of Europeans first heard the Beatles.
Hmm. Well, I wonder, and I'm going way far afield here, but you remember the movie Good Morning Vietnam?
I do.
Was there any resonance with that, or was it pure fantasy?
That was set in Vietnam, of course, and I was on an AFN in Germany, but you know, we were a cadre of five Air Force and Army personnel, and then a civilian workforce as well that did the administrative and the technical stuff. But we were broadcasters having a good time. One of my favorite experiences involved interviewing George Patton's son, who had just become the commander of the very same military unit that his father had commanded in Europe. And that was just when the Patton movie, George C. Scott's movie, had come out. The General Patton that I interviewed wouldn't talk about the movie, but he did talk about his father.
Yeah. Not surprised about that, I guess. What was it like covering the U.S. Capitol in that era?
Well, of course, my eyes were wide open. I mean, it was a new experience for a budding journalist. But to see the people that you read and then had contact with, the people who were in the news all the time, was an interesting experience. I like to tell my I wrote about my experiences with two of Illinois senators, Charles Percy and Everett Dirksen. I interviewed Everett Dirksen just a year or so before he died, and then of course it was in the U.S. Capitol. But I interviewed Percy in the building that was later named for Everett Dirksen. So I mean, it was an eye-opening experience, and for me, when I went home back to Bloomington, I could tell myself, you know, you stood toe-to-toe with U.S. senators, so you can probably handle the mayor.
Yeah. How do you come to host Problems and Solutions? Tell us about that.
Problems and Solutions was one of the early radio talk shows back when technology suddenly allowed you to put telephones on the radio. And so it had been in existence for I'm going to say, 20 years already at that point. But I was given the job as part of, I joined a reputable news staff there at WJBC, and then given the job of hosting this call-in show, which in some sense was the social media of the time. That's where you connected. That's where you solved your problems and talked about the issues of the day and had some interesting guests on, just like you do, along the way.
It's interesting because now there's this whole vogue for solutions journalism, right, which is don't just tell the story of the problem, but say how other people are addressing a problem in the reporting. I guess everything that's old or everything that's new is old. Everything that's old is new again. Yeah, I get that expression.
It comes back.
Yeah. Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Steve Vogel, a longtime radio broadcaster from the Bloomington Normal area. But we are talking to him today because he's out with a memoir called Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories, including some I'd just as soon forget. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. All right, Betty Friedan, Phyllis Schlafly. I think for our maybe for some of our younger listeners, you're going to have to begin by reminding us who they were, and then we can talk about how you came to be moderating a debate between them.
Back in those days, Illinois was kind of the linchpin, the keystone state in whether or not the Equal Rights Amendment was going to become part of the U.S. Constitution. Phyllis Schlafly, who was from Alton, was probably more responsible than any other individual in the country for the ERA not being part of the Constitution even today. She ran an outfit called Stop ERA. Stop stood for Stop Taking Our Privileges. And by the way, she was also probably more responsible than any individual for Barry Goldwater being the GOP presidential nominee back in the day. Betty Friedan, right behind Susan B. Anthony, was probably more responsible for the women's lib movement than any other person. They were going to debate at Illinois State University, meet each other for the very first time. So I arranged for them to begin the day in my broadcast studio. They had never met one another before, but they did meet in my studio, and it was quite the event, almost a hair-pulling match.
So they're not cordial off mic.
No.
No.
Phyllis Schlafly arrived on time, early, dressed in a suit, her hair up, lots of makeup, very prim and proper. Betty Friedan almost didn't get there on time. Her hair was down. She had been visiting relatives in Peoria and came over to Bloomington and got there just in time for the broadcast. When she entered the studio, they didn't greet each other. They just sat there. At one point, Betty Friedan called Phyllis Schlafly an Aunt Tom and said, I'd like to burn you at the stake. Phyllis Schlafly kept calling Friedan honey, and that really upset her. And during the commercials, they didn't speak to, or the news break, they didn't speak to each other. They just sat there. It really literally felt like the temperature in the room went down 5 or 10 degrees.
Wow.
In the room. It was a chilly situation. Years later, a few years after Betty Friedan died, and a couple of years before Phyllis died, I talked to Phyllis and asked her if she remembered that. She, oh, yeah, she did. And I said, why didn't you have any small talk during the commercial breaks? You know, usually opponents, politicians who are in a debate, they'll make small talk. They'll talk about the weather or how's your family and that type of stuff. There was none of that. I said, why? She said, "I never chatted up those women libbers. They always wake up mad."
Hmm.
So she could always still, she could still stick it to her, even though Phyllis was 92 years old, maybe at that point, but she could still stick it to her.
How do you prepare for something like that, for an event like that?
Well, you, of course, there were a lot of issues surrounding, percolating through the ERA at the time, so you just boned up on what the issues were, what people were saying about what impact the ERA would or wouldn't have on our lives, why it wasn't important, and let them have at it, and they did. I'm not sure if I declared a winner, but it was entertaining and interesting cultural experience.
I wonder what you make of today. I think, you know, there would be calls for, what would you say, deplatforming or not giving a platform to someone who espouses things that are hateful or something like that. You do hear that, people criticizing the media saying, how can you give that person a platform? I wonder if you have a perspective on that.
Well, I do. I regret that we no longer have a fairness doctrine in broadcasting. It used to be that you were obligated as a public broadcaster to present both sides or all sides of an argument.
And not just a public broadcaster in the sense of NPR, you mean any broadcast
had a license, you were obligated to show fairness. And that was dissolved as a doctrine, and I think we are poorer for it. Now we, between broadcasting and social media, too many of us spend too much time just searching out media that confirms our beliefs. We don't, we're not willing to hear the other side much, and I think we're poorer for that.
And talk radio was one of the sort of vanguards of that change, yeah? How did you experience that?
Yeah, I was kind of at the beginning of that. I moved off of radio in 1993, but back then, that time was when Rush Limbaugh and others were coming on strong, mostly conservative talk radio. But there were some efforts on the liberal side, too. They didn't gain as much traction as Limbaugh did, though.
Yeah. One of the other debates you moderated was between the Reverend Wesley Eights and Paul Cantor of Jefferson Starship. How did that come about?
Wesley Eights was a evangelical minister in Bloomington who had achieved some national attention when he burned a stack of rock and roll records, saying that they were evil, that they were the voice of the devil. In fact, he claimed that if you played a certain Beatles record backwards, you could hear the devil talking. And so that got some national attention, including the attention of Paul Cantor, who had founded Jefferson Starship, Jefferson Airplane.
Yep.
And Starship was going to launch a 20-city tour at Illinois State University in Normal. So I contacted him and to see if he would like to debate Reverend Eights when he came to ISU. And he did. And they did. We didn't do it at the broadcast studio because I wanted a studio audience for that.
Sure.
But we also kept it secret as to where we're going to be because I didn't want to attract a huge crowd. So we told Reverend Eights that he could bring 25 of his church members if he wanted. And then we let about 25 college students in. And so there at the Bone Student Center at ISU, we had the debate. And so it went on for more than an hour. I'm not sure there was a winner of that but what really surprised me was how much they respect they had for each other. Cantor, in fact, we learned during a commercial break, had called Reverend Eights that morning at 7:30 in the morning, woke up the pastor, and they had a more than an hour-long conversation on the phone before the debate actually occurred. During the debate, they took the gloves off a little bit, and Reverend Eights was still intent on saving Paul Cantor. Don't think he got that done, but it was interesting and another cultural experience.
Yeah. All right. We're going to continue with Steve Vogel after another break here. He is the author of a new memoir called Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories including some I'd just as soon forget. More to come. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
Boy and girl, there just one love in this whole world, and I know I found mine. The heavenly touch of your embrace tells me no one could take your place.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are speaking with Steve Vogel, who is known for a number of things, including a career as a broadcast journalist, mostly in Bloomington Normal, also the author of the true crime book, Reasonable Doubt, and he's got a new memoir called Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories, including some I'd just as soon forget. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. So before the break, we were talking about a debate you moderated between a reverend named Wesley Yates and Paul Cantor of Jefferson Starship about whether, I guess, rock music was satanic. You know, we're still having some of those culture war debates. I think maybe that particular culture war was obviously settled, at least among most Americans. But it seems like a lot of the things we're still arguing about in American politics today are things that, you know, the groundwork was certainly laid back then, and some of the divides, the battle lines were drawn back then. I wonder if you know, how you compare and contrast the rancor that you see in public discourse today with what was happening in that era we've been talking about.
Well, it certainly isn't as polite. We know that. But we've been through rough times before. I mean, this is a rough spot in American history right now, I think. But as I was talking about 1968, that was a horrible year in so many different ways. But there were, you know, many tough times before then, the Depression and Civil War and obviously the Revolution.
Jim Crow, sure, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, that one of the stark differences between my early journalism days and today's, I sometimes wonder if we weren't better off when we had fewer channels. There was a time when most of us watched Walter Cronkite or Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw, and at least we pretty much agreed on what the facts were. And that was the beginning of a discussion where we could debate, but we had a common set of understanding of what the facts are. Today, we don't even have that sometimes. We dispute what is the reality of a situation. And part of that is because we have so many different channels that are telling us so many different things. The credibility in some media is lacking. It's hard to sort out which ones to believe. And we have to, I think we are missing a chance if we don't help educate young people on how to understand the media and make good selections on what you watch and listen to and read.
So you think we need more gatekeepers like we had back in the day?
I don't know what the answer to that is. I'm not sure we had more gatekeepers.
Well, I mean, like you said, there were three channels. I think the Walter Cronkite and his producers had much more of a say than whoever is working with John Dickerson now on CBS News.
Yeah. So maybe there were fewer gatekeepers. I mean, I can imagine a situation back then. There was a situation when someone burnt a Quran, I think. And that was a flashpoint in the news and got a lot of people excited, understandably. I can imagine a situation where Peter Jennings called up Walter Cronkite and would say, "Hey, are you guys doing anything with that nutball down in Florida who burnt the Quran?" And Walter Cronkite says, "No, I don't think we are." And then Peter would say, "I don't think we are either." And we wouldn't know about it, and we wouldn't get excited about it.
Mm.
I don't know if that's good or bad, but that's different.
Yeah. It is different that, if you were listening to AM radio, maybe you'd hear some of the fringier people in American life call in every now and then if they got through the screeners and they got put on air. Nowadays, you can find out some random person in rural Idaho thinks about the news of the day and have that person made, you know, the internet's main character, as they say.
Back when I was doing talk radio, I was sometimes criticized for letting people who were kind of on the edge have a little platform. But I've always been willing to be open-minded and open-hearted in that. And usually there's at least one grain of truth in what someone is trying to get a sense of why they feel the way they do about things.
A couple other things I want to ask you about from the book that struck us as interesting. Might seem a little random, but why don't you eat chicken?
I have a psychological barrier and even talking about it, obviously. Chicken. It had to do with when I was called upon as a probably a 12-year-old to execute some chickens. And I don't want to upset people at lunch or dinner time here, but my father had always been in charge of ending chickens' lives when we wanted to have some chicken on the table on the farm, and then put a few in the freezer as well for future use. But one day my dad wasn't there, and my mother asked me whether I could manage to do it. And I did manage to do it, but it was a traumatic event for me, and had a lasting impact, and I just really would prefer not to eat chicken.
Yeah. Do you think we're out of touch? I interviewed someone a few years ago who argued that more people should take up hunting just for... not the sport of it, just to understand where their food really comes from.
It's a good point. I mean, I enjoy a hamburger and a steak.
Yeah,
and I've witnessed the butchering and participated in a small way in that task on the farm. But so I'm a hypocrite in most ways. But the experience I had of having to take care of seven chickens was not a good one.
Something else you talk about, again, shifting sort of randomly here, male tears. I wonder what changes you've seen in the way society reacts to men showing emotion.
I say in the book that I'm a crier, and I've always been emotional. I really was as a kid. I would cry a drop of a hat and probably had a reputation in school for that, was embarrassed by it. I've become less so over the years, but at the same time, society has become more accepting of male tears. We see some very high-profile people, Barack Obama and LeBron James, shed tears in public.
Jimmy Kimmel got choked up the other night.
He did. He did. I saw that, and with good reason. I understand that. So I think we men are a little more in touch with our feelings, and maybe it's probably good we don't keep it held in so much.
How did you become a true crime writer?
Well, that was a factor of the fact that I covered a trial that was involving a horrendous crime in Bloomington some 40 years ago now, where three young children and their mother were found brutally slain in their beds. And there had been very little said about the circumstances of the case, about any motive in that thing. But the father and husband had been charged with the crime. The trial took place in Rockford, Illinois, on a change of venue, even though the crime occurred in Bloomington, 140 miles to the south. And I covered every minute of that for WJBC in Bloomington. And it became apparent that it was a heck of an interesting story. It's a completely circumstantial case in which the death penalty was sought, and ultimately the father and husband was found guilty, and the judge declined to impose the death penalty. David Hendricks went to prison for 7 years when the state Supreme Court, after reopening the case, ordered a new trial in which he was found not guilty and was released from prison. So it became the subject of a book, and as you said, became a New York Times bestseller, and has been published in different forms over the years.
It's continued to be held up as sort of an example. Talk about how you, I mean, did you have the doubts when you were covering the trial? Because you structure the book Sort of like choose your own adventure. Maybe that's a little flip of a way to say it. But.
Well, it definitely is a courtroom drama. Much of the book is about what transpired in the courtroom. And really my intent was, because the trial was held so far away from Bloomington, my original intent was to give the people who were truly interested in the case a complete picture of what the facts were as presented to that jury, a jury that voted in its first vote 6-6 in terms of innocence or guilt. So it was a very close case, but it was completely circumstantial, and Reasonable Doubt, the title of the book, describes the circumstance, and in fact, as you indicated, actually is used as a textbook in some criminal justice courses to illustrate the concept of reasonable doubt.
I wonder if that changed the way you think of the way policing is done, the way investigations are done in America, through that experience or others you covered.
For good or bad, in Bloomington Normal, there have been several cases where police investigations and prosecution have been called into question. There's the Jamie Snow case right now that just recently got the attention of John Grisham in an op-ed in the Chicago Tribune. So, yeah, it's a factor that the public is very aware of where I come from and still talked about.
Were you surprised by the reception to the book, that it sort of captured this national attention? Like you said, you were originally writing it for your local audience.
Yeah, well, I had the luck of it being published by St. Martin's Press, which had a great distribution system. I was on the Larry King show, and that helped boost it along a bit. So I wasn't surprised, but I was gratified.
So let's we're just coming to the end of our time together. We're going out with an Elvis song here, Can't Help Falling in Love. Can you tell the story from the book about a classmate of yours who had a bit of a checkered history with that song?
Well, it's a little story. I rode a school bus for an extended period each day for years, and
kids in rural areas have to do sometimes.
Yeah, and yeah. I was about as far away from the school as you could get, so I got on early in the morning and got off late in the afternoon. And there was a young woman, a child really, probably a 6th or 7th grader, who got on the bus, and she had a beautiful voice. And she told us about a song that she had written. And there were a couple of us who were really taken by it. It was a remarkable lyric and melody. And we even kind of learned it and learned to harmonize on it.
Wow.
And this went on for a couple of days, and we sang it on the bus. And we were starting to plot about how we might introduce this song to the world. It was so good. And then one morning, my friend who was singing with us on the bus got on the bus and said, "I just heard her song on the radio. It's really Elvis's song. I just heard it on WLS. And it was a song that's become very familiar to the world. So this poor girl, she was a foster child. Mm. In an effort to garner some attention, she made up the idea that she had produced this song when really it was somebody else's. But it was a great song, and we had some fun with it for a while. But it taught me a little bit about girls, too.
Yeah. Maybe a little journalistic skepticism as well.
Yeah.
Steve Vogel, his book is called Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories, including some I just as soon forget. Thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
So happy, and thank you for not asking me about the some I'd like to forget.
That'll be part two. That's all the time we have for our show today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.
But I can't help falling in love with you.
some things of me.